Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guests are Faye Kellerman and Jonathan Kellerman, who have a new double novel called Double Homicide, two novellas packed in as one novel back-to-back, kind of like the old ace doubles that used to appear in science fiction and, I think, westerns way back when. Jonathan Kellerman is the author of the Alex Delaware series of mysteries. There are several other characters and books that he's written. And Faye Kellerman is the author of several Peter Decker Rena Lazarus mysteries. They're a married couple who work together, and Faye Kellerman has said that her best editor is Jonathan Kellerman. And I would guess that the same is true in reverse.
Absolutely.
What prompted you to finally get together and write novels?
One of the common questions that we were asked, will you ever collaborate? We always said, no. Writing is the only privacy we have after 32 years of marriage and four kids and hectic lives. I'm not sure exactly what led us to do it. A friend of ours is a TV producer, and he said, can we do a project? And we were reluctant because we do books. We don't do movies and film and TV. But we finally agreed to consider it, and we came up with two ideas for television. And one of them was this notion of teams of detectives solving crimes in various cities to explore the regionalism of America while it's still here. And then we said, no, that's too good of an idea for TV. Let's do a book. So that's really how the book got started. But we had to convince ourselves that collaboration would be a good idea.
I think this is a novel that could only have been written at this point in our career after 20 years of writing. Because to write with anybody, especially fiction writing, creative writing, where your soul and your heart goes into whatever you're putting down on paper, you have to be able to leave your ego at the door. If not, you're writing together, why are you changing this? What are you doing? This, I had this in mind when you did it. If you can't cooperate in a process, you shouldn't be doing it together.
And we didn't know that we could do it. We had to find out.
What prompted you to, rather than create one novel, long novel, to create these two long novellas?
Well, the whole notion is to stretch. When you write within a genre, and on top of that you write within a series, there are a lot of limitations. I, for one, am easily bored, and I'm always trying to stretch within the confines. And Faye and I have written a lot of novels. I think we've written 43 books, and short stories, essays, everything but the novella. And the novella is an interesting form. It's not a short story. It's not a novel. We wanted to see whether we could do it. It was really a creative adventure on many levels. Could we collaborate? Could we create new characters? Could we work as a team? And could we write in this form? What would it feel like to write in this form? We approached projects not from a commercial standpoint, but really, honestly, from a creative standpoint. We thought it would be fun to try something new, but doesn't take the place of writing our individual novels.
I have to say, it really turned out to be a lot of fun. First of all, to write with a different set of detectives, a different team. Second, to write in a different city. And our idea was choosing different cities, not Los Angeles, where Alex Delaware is based and where Peter Decker is based, but to have the city be the third member of this two-duo team to solve crimes. We wanted to use cities as a character. And for the next double homicide that is coming out, we're actually going to set it here in the Bay Area, either Oakland or Berkeley or San Francisco. We're not quite sure yet. Because the city, of course, has the distinct characters. And because we chose Boston and Santa Fe, because they're both very, very different, regions geographically, different personalities in their cities. And, of course, the duo of homicide detectives reflects that.
I'm just going to say, when Faye said we had fun, I think that's a risky statement because there's this notion that if you're having fun, it can't be substantial. For some reason, we like artists to suffer and to open up veins, and there's plenty of that goes with the territory. But on some level, I think it's good for the writer to enjoy what he or she is doing. I think if the writer enjoys it, the reader is more likely to enjoy it.
Well, the style in the book is not either of your styles,
right,
but it's very transparent style. I mean, when you were working on this, when you were dealing with the style, the manner in which you wrote that, the way it looks, how did that work in terms of trying to keep your own individual idiosyncrasies out, or how did you do that?
It was really a fascinating process because I do appreciate you're saying that because it's not Faye's voice, it's not my voice. And I'm always amazed at how stereotypical voice is. I always think with a new book I'm breaking out a voice, then I go back and read it, it's the same voice.
Same thing, yeah.
Yeah. But this was really a new voice of the two of us, for better or for worse. And we didn't set out to do anything. We never intended to change voice. We simply wrote, and through the collaborative process of passing it back and forth, it just created something new.
It evolved. We thought of detectives. We thought of a plot, very sketchy, very outliney. We wrote drafts, and then we emailed it back and forth. And I think the email process really worked well because when he made changes, I couldn't visibly see it. I could read and see what changes were made, but I couldn't see him actually changing sentences, changing names, crossing out words. It really helped.
Did you talk about it over the dinner table, too, or was it just something when you were just working?
Just pass it back and forth. And I think, you know what, facing it would be hard for me to sit and watch her mark up my draft. But the email, the technology really helped. And I've come to think of it as kind of like making sausage. You don't want to see the process, but the outcome is okay.
And you had no desire to go back to the draft you emailed and go, oh, Jonathan did this or that, or did you?
Sometimes I couldn't even recognize specifically how he had changed it, only that he had changed it, and he had changed it for the better. And I think it went through its own evolution insofar as towards the end when we were finishing a draft, it was almost exciting to see how it would be changed, or you get to a point in the plot where you had this vague idea of how you wanted to end, but you weren't quite sure exactly how to get there, which route to take, and you'd be stuck in a corner. Usually when I'm stuck in a corner in my own mystery novels, it's only me, myself, and I who can pull myself, find the trap door. This time I said, let Jonathan find the trap door.
It was a matter of context. I can't emphasize how protective I am of my novels. I mean, it's the next most important thing after my children. And I feel the same way. I don't want anybody messing with them. I do accept editing. I'm open to that, but really it's my novel. And in this, because at the outset we understood it was collaborative, there was the real joy and the sense of adventure. What's Faye going to do with it?
One of the things about a well-constructed mystery novel, some people do it instinctively. You've said about your Alex Delaware novels that one of the difficulties is that they are so heavily structured,
right,
even before you sit down and put a word into your computer. How do you deal with structure in this case, when you've got a complicated structure? Do you just know the beginning and end and then just play with the middle? Or?
I outline. Other writers don't. Elmore Leonard doesn't. I mean, those people are smarter than I am. I just can't do it without outlining. I find that outlining gives me a sense of comfort and prevents me from blocking. I never block because the analogy that I like to use is like building a house. I'm framing up the house. The writing, the fun part, is the decorating, but without the structure, the substructure, some people are able to do it. We outlined these novellas not as extensively as the novels, but they still did have a beginning, middle, end structure. We knew where they were going. That said, both of us will outline and then rarely consult the outline. It's doing the outline that helps. And then you finish the book, and it's totally different from the outline. So it's almost a comfort sense of thinking your story through. But every day you sit down and write, you're inventing, and it goes in so many different directions.
Who invented the four major characters? There's got to be a point where someone says, okay, the Boston characters, we're creating a female black detective, and we're pairing her with this Irish guy. Or in the case of Santa Fe, we're pairing an Indian with a very, very extensive backstory with a Jewish guy from New York.
Because the city dictated what kind of characters we wanted to portray. We could have easily portrayed an Indian in the Boston story. We chose Boston because our son had lived in Boston for 6 years, and that involved a lot of travel back and forth and a lot of overnight or week stays there. So we had a little bit of a feel for Boston. Santa Fe we know very, very well. We go there quite often. We love the city. The mountains are beautiful there. And it's just from talking to people, plus using the city as the third character that dictated the two detectives.
To some extent, you have to paint in broad strokes. It's impressionistic. You're doing the novella, you're saying more with less. You don't want to be cliched, but to ignore colleges in Boston would just as artificial, and to ignore art in Santa Fe. So you want to feature it, but feature it in a non-stereotypic way. You can't get away from colleges in Boston. You can't get away from art in Santa Fe. So to that extent, you embrace that and make that part of the story, but it needs to go beyond that.
Did you feel at all during writing these, knowing you're not going to go back to these characters again, a certain regret
yes.
on either of your parts?
Very. I mean,
absolutely.
I'm more sentimental. I say, honey, I love these guys. I want to do another. She says, no, we got to move on. But I never say never, because until a year ago, we said we'd never collaborate. So I've learned to be open-minded.
Let's go back. First of all, neither of you were writing when you met, correct?
I was.
You were.
I was a failed writer, and Faye wasn't writing. Faye was an internal writer. I was a failed writer.
And what year did you start writing Alex Delaware?
Alex Delaware came later, but I've been writing since the age of 9, compulsively, and I wrote all through high school, all through college. And when I went to college, I worked on the daily. I went to UCLA, and I was very young when I started college, and I went to a small high school into a big college. So I found my niche at the Daily Bruin. I was a cartoonist, the editorial cartoonist for the Daily Bruin for 4 years. And once you work on a paper, you get to do other things. So I did journalism. I did editing. I was a critic. I won a literary award. I won a Goldwyn Award in my senior year in college in 1971 and published my first novel in 1985. So it was 14 years of abject stress and failure and frustration.
But during those years, you were a child psychologist.
Yeah, during those years, I was getting a PhD and a postdoc in psych, a medical school professorship, publishing psychology books, publishing op-ed pieces, a lot of scientific, so everything but full-length fiction, published a couple of short stories. But I really thought of myself as a failed writer with a really good day job.
At the time that you began writing the Alex Delaware series, was anybody else using a psychologist as a detective?
Apparently, there was a fellow who wrote in the 30s, and I found this out because there was a professor at Stanford who contacted me and wrote an article about me after I got published. Apparently, there was another guy who did it in the 30s. There have been a few things here and there, but I think I was really probably the first one in decades to be able to integrate my professional experience in writing fiction. My inspiration was Joe Wamba, who's this wonderful writer and a police detective and a wonderful human being as well. And I said, here's this guy with specialized knowledge who's a good writer. Maybe I can do that too.
And Faye, your first novel was published?
In 1986.
So it was a year later.
Right.
So you had been in a similar situation, raising kids and trying to write, too.
I was always the imaginative kid, the Charlie or the Marty with the imaginary friend. And it was really Jonathan who was my inspiration and my first mentor and my first editor, as you pointed out. And he really gave me the encouragement to write, although he didn't know that I was writing at the time. I sort of presented him with some full-length work and said, help me out with this. And he did. And if it hadn't been for Jonathan, I wouldn't have even dared to write. Seeing him gave me a lot of encouragement.
Well, what she saw was she saw me failing. So I think it's a testament to Faye that she was able to take inspiration.
Well, your first novel was Ritual Bath, right?
Right.
Which was basically a Rena Lazarus novel, and Decker, the cop, was a minor character, a lesser character. As time went on, he became more and more important, and there was a shift. I remember reading Ritual Bath, and, it read like a woman wrote it. By the time I read your later books, you couldn't tell anymore. What happened with you in terms of moving your books from that specific Orthodox Jewish woman look into what became a mystery series involving a detective?
I wish I could tell you that it was a conscientious and a purposeful decision. When I was writing The Ritual Bath, I had no idea it was going to get published. So I was just writing a story. As I realized that this could be potentially a series, when they offered me I can write another book and they'll publish that too, then I started realizing that I was a crime fiction writer, and to get this woman arbitrarily into a mishaps time after time after time is going to be very artificial. So we brought the crime directly to the professional, which was Peter. If Rena can naturally get into the story, I like to bring her in there. Fans like her. I like her. She's also developed a little bit. Somebody said, you got to get her out of the house a little bit. And that's probably true, but I have to do it in a natural way. Stories that don't involve her, that I can't get her into, she's just going to have to stay in the background.
And in those stories, there's less, the religious end of it becomes less important.
Exactly.
I mean, it's your choice. I mean, obviously, if she's in the background, that's a choice you've made.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The story comes to me. It's like the get a walk story. I'm thinking, I'm driving, I'm doing something mundane, and I get a what-if kind of inspiration. If it leads itself into a religious type of a story, I have no qualms about writing it. I don't purposely make saying, oh, I don't want to make this one religious. But if it doesn't, and I think it's a great story, and it always starts kind of with a theme, too, something I want to explore, jealousy, greed. If the two ideas that I have, the story and the theme, work well together, and Rena's a natural primary character, fine. But if not, that's okay. My main concern is writing the book that I want to write.
What happens if you get a really good idea that the main character would probably work best as a psychologist? For you, what if you get a really good idea that takes place in the Orthodox community?
I don't think that's happened. What's happened is it's more likely that we'll be experiencing something at the same time or reading an article, and we might say, I think that would be good for you, or Faye will clip something out of the paper and say, honey, you might want to think about this. The stories are never that monolithic or simple, that it's about Orthodox, about this, about
right,
that.
Yeah.
I mean, they're complex. They're really about people. I mean, our books have not been adapted for film, and that's another common question, because you can't pitch them. You can't say, gee, it's like dinosaurs are roaming the earth. And they're even hard to put covers on. When they put a cover on my book and write flap copy, you can't really sum them up in one sentence. It's a complex story that comes over a period of years. I always tell my kids, I say, nothing bad can happen to a writer because it's all material.
I think one of the reasons that they don't do well in TV or movies, or they have problems, is even though they're crime fiction novels, so they're heavily plot-driven, essentially they're characters. They're novels about characters. And that's always hard to put a label on.
Because they're complex that way, it's also hard to break them down into the 80 or 90 pages
exactly.
needed,
exactly.
as opposed to Double Homicide, where both stories might be more adaptable because they're simpler.
Exactly. I mean, there is a simplicity. You try to put as much of it in your 150 pages, but it's just a different form. It's impressionistic painting.
You're listening to an interview with Jonathan and Faye Kellerman, whose book is titled Double Homicide, Boston and Santa Fe. Do you ever intend at some point to mix and match in the two back-to-back stories?
I can never say never, but that isn't the plan. We'll see how the series does and how much fun we continue to have with it. Right now, the plan is to really have that city be its own distinct identity.
Jonathan Kellerman, what's Faye Kellerman's best book?
Honestly, I'm a big fan of Faye's books. There's a book she wrote called Prayers for the Dead that is so emotionally resonant that it stayed with me. If I had to pick one, that's the book that I would pick. It's a very powerful novel, and Faye's a wonderful writer. But I'm really lucky, and I'm not saying this in a smarmy way, but when Faye showed me the manuscript of what became The Ritual Bath, she presented it to me. I was holding our child, who is a college sophomore, was a baby. And I remember the moment very, very distinctly, and Faye said, here, read this, you won't like it. I was vaguely aware she'd been, but I was still practicing psychology, so I'd go to the office, and she'd sneak away and write while I was gone. And I said to myself, she's right. I mean, how could she have any talent? She's a math major. You know, she's a scientist. To my amazement, I did like it. And I told her, no, honey, it's really good. She says, no. She thought I was patronizing her, so we had a little fight because I liked it. So honestly, thank God. I thank God every day that I love Faye's writing, because I could love Faye and despise her writing, but I really like her writing. And that's made life a lot easier, and it's made it possible to collaborate.
It's also made it possible for you to be her editor.
Yeah, and I really don't edit. I mean, when she says that in the early days, we would both read and comment, but it's not that I really sat and marked up her manuscript. I mean, I guess you could call editing, but not now. I think one of the reasons we couldn't have done this collaboration 20 years ago, we didn't have the confidence. It's only now we have the confidence to be able to sit down and share. You know, sharing has to come from a place where you're feeling good about yourself, really. You have to be able to give. And in the early days, we would share weekly chunks of stuff. And as Faye likes to say, there were some cold nights because we were ill-prepared. We didn't know how to critique and how to accept criticism. As we gained confidence, it was a less frequent occurrence. I think I haven't seen Faye's book in progress in 300 pages. So there might have been some editing, but I certainly don't want people to think I was her Svengali. You know?
Turning that around, first of all, Faye, do you edit Jonathan in the same way?
I used to critique him. As a good reader would, as you would, as he would do to me. And that's more or less what we do now. We'll take a big chunk of the book 200 pages, and we'll say, oh, you called the character Connor on page 210, but on 110 you called him Connell. Which one is it?
Right.
Or something of that nature. There's a logical leap. She couldn't have possibly deduced this from the information you give. You need another paragraph. These two paragraphs don't make sense. You need a segue here. Things like that.
That's the job, quote unquote, for the editor or even the line editor back in New York. They're not doing their jobs for other people. You can see the downward spiral in a lot of works because of that.
You know, it's really a risk. The risk that we face, if you've written a lot of bestsellers, your whole relationship with the editor changes in that they want to please you. And so whenever I have a new editor, and I don't change them very often, and I've had wonderful editors, been very lucky, I always tell them, please don't be afraid to... I've never written a book that was not improved by judicious editing, but... they always tell me I give them the cleanest stuff they ever got. So if you look at one of my manuscripts, it's hardly even marked up.
That's because he marks it up. I'm a big perfectionist.
I do 20 drafts myself. I still screw up, and it's really a humbling job because no matter what, I'll still have a person leave a room twice. And you've gone through it, and proofreaders and line editor. And if you think of yourself as a perfectionist, obsessive compulsive as I do, it's really humbling. Our son just sold a couple of novels to Putnam. People won't believe it, but being our son did not help him. It really closed doors to him. But despite the fact he's a talented guy, and he just got his first script back from his editor. And once again, he said it was very minimal because he's a very perfectionist. The worst guys, according to editors, are journalists, because journalists are so used to handing stuff into editors.
And then they rewrite it anyway.
So many editors have complained journalists hand in these really sloppy drafts.
Faye Kellerman, what is Jonathan Kellerman's? What's your favorite book by Jonathan Kellerman, or his best book?
I liked Over the Edge. I liked Butcher's Theater, and I liked the new book, Twisted. And I named three of them specifically because they feature three different characters. Butcher's Theater took place in Israel, and that was Daniel Shiravi. Delaware did a great job of being a child psychologist in Over the Edge. That relationship between him and Jamie was just phenomenal. And Twisted is the new one that features Petra Connor.
She's been a feature player in some of the Delaware.
In Billy Strait, which was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful novel. I like that as well. But she really comes into her own in this Twisted. And I like the partners she's working with without giving away the book. It involves a student who grew up from a rather disadvantaged background who, through sheer force of will and education and brilliance, came to meet and be with her in this capacity.
I noticed here in doing my own research, you basically stick, outside of Quality of Mercy, there might be another novel I don't know of, you stick to these two detectives, to this one series. Jonathan, you flash around to several different series.
Yeah.
And as time goes on, you're doing more in the other series and less in the Delaware. What is the difference between how you view what you're doing and, say, what Faye is doing?
Well, as a matter of fact, Faye is writing a novel set in Europe in the 20s, so she is also deviated. It's always a creative thing. I want to emphasize I love the Delaware novels. I'm not like Conan Doyle, who hated Holmes and killed him off and brought him back, and Chandler hated Marlowe. I like doing the Delaware novels. He's a great vehicle for telling a certain type of story. Petra Connor developed because she was a relatively bit player in a book in a Delaware novel called Survival of the Fittest, and I wrote her. And I always try never to have a minor character. Even minor characters are people. I like to flesh them out. And I wrote about her, and I said, she's a great character. It's the same longing I feel about these characters in Double Homicide. I do get attached to them. I said, A, she's a great character, and B, I wonder if I can write a female main character. Because I know Faye was really good at writing male characters. She's had a lot of writers say, you write the best male characters.
Well, that's what I was talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly, you were remarking. So I wanted to see whether I could write. I'm always trying to challenge and test myself. And that's how she came in. Now, I wrote Billy Strait a few years ago. I've written a bunch of Delaware since. I'm not writing fewer Delawares. I'm just adding other books and overworking. But basically, another story that I thought would suit her came up, and I wrote this novel, Twisted. But I also have a Delaware finished called Rage. I guess I'm on the one-word titles now, and that's coming out in May.
How about sales? Do sales vary between the Delawares and the others, or is it pretty consistent?
The Delawares sell a little bit more, except in Europe, it's really interesting. Europe people are much more open to non-series books. Americans are very provincial. They really like what I call the comfort of the familiar. So I always get a lot of mail saying, okay, it's great, but when's Delaware coming? It's just amazing to me how people, and as a novelist, you always want to stretch and do different things. But if you change things, people don't like it. But I don't care. I do what I want to do anyway.
Why generally have you just stuck, Faye, to Decker and Lazarus rather than creating other characters?
Well, I had Quality of Mercy, and then I had Moon Music, which takes place in contemporary Las Vegas. So that was another character. That was Romulus Poe, and I'd like to bring him back. And then the one I'm writing now is another historical, because I had this idea forever, called Straight Into Darkness, and it takes place between the wars in Munich, Germany. And it features a serial killer in Munich. And in doing my researches, there were quite a few serial killers in Germany at that time. And, of course, Fritz Lang did the whole thing of M with the Child. And on top of having that as a theme in Germany at that time, you have this whole underbelly of the rise of Nazism that was taking place, obviously, then. I've also done two novels that feature Decker's daughter, Cindy Decker. So she's almost like a series unto itself, too. So like Jonathan said, we do try to stretch and we do try to create. And I liked writing with Cindy. My latest novel that had come out last year called Street Dreams featured her and her own beau because I like the added injection of youth.
One of the key questions to anybody writing a series is, how do you stay fresh?
Exactly.
Because if you write the same thing over and over, it's going to get really boring.
That's why it was wonderful to write from Cindy's point of view, and that's why it was advantageous, though I didn't think of this in the beginning at all, for Decker to have this family that we have seen growing up for the last 20 years. They grew up and aged a lot slower than I did, but at least in this particular case, we can have a second generation if I so choose, and I think she's a detective now, and she's pretty good at it.
I think the way to keep it fresh is to only write for the right reasons. I mean, it's going to sound self-righteous and pompous, but I may have a contract for 5 books, but I'm not going to sit down and write that book until I'm feeling good about it. I have a lot of flexibility. I mean, basically, if I call my publisher and say, I don't want to do a book, it's going to be another year or two, they would say, fine.
Yeah.
But don't sit down and write unless you really are into the process.
Yeah.
If it's fresh for you, it's going to be fresh for the reader. I can't speak for other writers, but I just couldn't live and be happy if I was just hacking it out. I mean, that would be a very unpleasant life.
You can't write for money.
No, I mean, that's the irony that there's no one less commercial than I am. I mean, the interesting thing, I gave an interview where I talked about the fact that films that I like bomb, music that I like is not on the hit list, I don't have commercial taste, yet I've written 22 consecutive bestsellers. I'm astounded by it. My first novel, I wrote about a shrink and a gay cop. This is not commercial. In 1981, that was not commercial.
Right.
It became a bestseller, and then people are saying, oh, what a great commercial idea. Kellerman is so calculating. I've heard about writers who sit down with a computer and try to figure out, how do you do this, how do you do that? It's just not the way that I operate. So I'm astounded and very pleased that enough people buy these books that I don't have to do another job.
If you look at any kind of art, whether it be music, whatever, generally speaking, I found this to be the case. If the artist is taking a risk, they stand a chance of success. Maybe not. Maybe the risk will fail. If they don't take that risk, if they just do it for money, and we see it all the time in really, really bad movies.
Exactly.
You're more likely to bomb.
That's beautifully put. That's exactly what happens. Somebody thinks of something original. Then everyone imitates it. You know, it's like TV. You have a good premise for a TV show. There's an interesting show. Everyone imitates it. And then they all fail, and they wonder why. And film and TV are based on that, really. With a book, it's harder because it takes a long time to really write a real book, not a phony book. So it's harder for a committee to sit around and say, go write a book. Harvey Weinstein can't dispatch novelists to go write books. I mean, to some extent, he can do other things, but there are limitations because the writing of a good novel is takes a long time, and it's a tough job.
A number of writers now are getting involved with television, specifically HBO shows like The Wire. Mm-hmm. Have either of you given thought to trying to do something creative at that end?
Well, that's how Double Homicide kind of
that's how
came
it started,
out of
yeah.
the hopper. The creative other idea that we had, and it was a very, very good script, is still floating around there in TV miasma. And maybe it'll get picked up and maybe it won't. But when we had this idea, as John says, of Double Homicide, at a certain point, after taking a meeting or two meetings, I turned to him and I said, let's just pull it. Let's not even pitch it as an idea. It's too good. This lends itself very, very well to a novel form. And then because it came out of television in a more condensed form, it naturally evolved into the short novel or the novella form.
I mean, I think that's a good example of why we like to write books. Two ideas. One's still floating around in the miasmas phase, and the other one's already published with a contract for it's a real book. In 1971, when I won the Goldwyn Award, that's generally a stepping stone to the film business. Even then, I didn't want to write. I got called in by agents. I was a kid. I was 21. They said, well, big cigars, literally, and said, well, kid, what do you want to do? I said, I'm going to get a PhD in psychology and treat children because that's what I like. So the film biz, TV, it's collaborative, and that's what I don't like about it. I like sitting in a room by myself and writing. This is the first time I've ever – I mean, I did do some comedy writing in college, and that lends itself to a bunch of people sitting in a room. You build on each other's humor. But dramatic writing, this is the first time I've ever collaborated with anybody, and it was a very good experience. But for a full-length novel, I don't want to sit and take meetings. I was in academic medicine for 15 years. I attended way too many meetings, and – film and TV are collaborative, as they should be. Writing fiction is a hermetic job, and that's what I like about it.
You can't escape social issues or political issues in your books. I mean, it's impossible.
It's part of the world. Yeah.
It's part of the world. Do you ever think in terms of trying to explore or take a particular point of view in a book and see where it goes?
I say if you have a message, use Western Union. I tend to write about social issues because I was a psychologist and I dealt with people and I enjoy doing that. But I like to keep my personal views as much as I can. Once in a while, something will sneak in. But especially in this age where everything is so polarized and politicized, I think it's welcome just to write, just to read a good story and not have to deal with this
there
stuff.
There has to also be timeless quality. There is a timeless quality about Jonathan's novels. And if you get too politicized, it dates the novels. It's not suited for either of our novels, where we're basically exploring the foibles and the wonderment of characters themselves.
And polemics don't really lend themselves to good writing. Upton Sinclair did important things, but if you go back and read the books, they're not very well written.
But on the other hand, whether you want to or not, political views, ideas come in because you're living in a specific time and place.
As long as they're done in proportion and grace, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just not what we choose to do. I choose not just to write political novels. I try to write one political novel, Time Bomb, and it ended up not being a political novel.
But you've also, I mean, you're dealing with gay issues with Milo.
But I didn't do that to be political. I did it simply because, I mean, Milo evolved. And because in 1981, when I sat down to write that book, after having been failed as a writer for many, many years, I was really tired of cliches. And I said, we're way too obsessed with what people do in bed in this country. And I had gay friends who just did their job and were gay. And I said, what if he just died? I knew I had to have a cop because this is a crime novel. I said, so boring, the grizzle cop. I'm going to make a grizzle cop who's gay. And you know, there were gay cops in LAPD, but they were all hidden. They did not exist. So I thought, now, the reception to that's been fascinating. When it first came out, because I was like one of the first guys to do it, oh, thank you. Then, how can Kellerman as a straight man presume to write about the gay lifestyle? I had another guy stand up and say, yes, the stodgiest gay guy I've ever met. You know, well, you know, you haven't met Rick, his partner. And it's once again, it's avoiding stereotype. Then I had a gay magazine in Britain say, if Delaware was really such a good shrink, he'd know he's really in love with Milo. We did a signing and someone came up and asked me, when is Delaware going to fall in love with Milo? You know, people's reactions, it's great. Fiction is a Rorschach test. And I just created him and he's a great character. And I enjoy, he's a conduit for my sense of humor. The things Delaware can say because he's a goody two shoes, Milo can say.
I forgot who I was talking to who once said that the problem with talking about being a writer is that 50% of the book is the reader, if not more.
Yeah, if not more.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's amazing how people respond to this stuff in ways that you never imagine. The deconstructionists are the absurd example of it. But Faye gets letters from people doing dissertations who are interpreting her books and nothing to do with her intention at all. I mean, it's a free country. You know?
Well, it's also, you know, the deconstructionists would say that it's totally valid for them to draw whatever they want to out of either of your books.
They could do whatever
they want. And they can always use the excuse they were writing about it, but it was so buried deep in their psyche they didn't even realize it.
I am a shrink. I understand value of interpretation up to a point.
If that's the case, has anybody walked up to you and said, what about such and such in a book? And you look and you go, holy crap. This is something in my book that's about me something deep within me that they caught that I didn't even know was there.
Reading Double Homicide, somebody pointed out, an interviewer pointed out, he said, you both used the expression in both novels, change is good. Did you do that on purpose? And I don't know if we were thinking, because it was a collaborative process and we were passing it back and forth, but that's so what these two novels are
that's
about.
True. That was pretty
change
astonishing.
Change is good.
Because we didn't realize it. In the Boston case, there was a character, John Chang, who changed him to change, and he said change is good. And it was a totally different context.
And in his, it was his father who was dying
Santa
Fe.
Who came up with that? Do you have any idea who?
We don't know which one, if either one of us wrote it for both, or if...
Who remembers?
I don't remember. I do remember that the Boston novel, I think, was written first, and then we did the Santa Fe. But there were times where we were doing both of them at the same time.
We were doing both of these and novels and marrying two of our kids off a month apart. It was a busy year.
But that change is good was so psychologically, so emblematic of the novels. He was doing a Petra Conner novel, which is different. I'm doing the Straight Into Darkness. And we were marrying off two children. So
it was a year full of turmoil.
So when you were writing these stories, you were also working on your own books.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
How did you keep it? All clear in your mind.
I don't know. We were nearly comatose. We married two children off 28 days apart. In addition to that, we had some bad things. My father died. Two of my good friends, including the musician Warren Zevon, died, and he was a good friend of mine. So it was a year of loss and of celebration, and it was just a crazy year.
Do you ever read your books afterward, or once they're in print, that's the end of it?
I never read them cover to cover. I may glimpse to it. Occasionally, I need to go back and do research and see what I've done. But no, that's the most boring thing is reading your own book. I want to read someone else's book.
When doing research on these books or any of your books, on these books, did you just like parcel it out, or did you just get online if you needed something?
Well, we traveled.
We traveled. Yeah. Both of us did the police research together, as we are going to do for the Bay Area book and for the book in Nashville. We just came back from Nashville where we spent 2 days with the Nashville PD. And we do this so we both can know what we're talking about when we switch drafts and we both have an idea and similar experiences. And that's what's really been fun, to have these similar experiences and have them interpreted very differently.
So when you were writing, who wrote chapter one first?
One wrote a draft and the other wrote a draft of the other story, and then we switched.
But we're not going to say that.
That's a little bit of mystery. We are going to leave.
So one of you wrote the first draft of each book.
Exactly. And then passed them. But I will say that one of our daughters guessed wrong.
So to that degree, the original format of the characters and how they were put together was one of you.
No, we conceived the characters. We discussed. We outlined. Then someone sat down and did a draft and then
we
emailed the draft.
The plots together, too. Yeah.
And then you went back and forth on the draft over and over.
We just kept going back and forth.
I wrote a chapter and then he wrote a chapter. And we wanted the initial thing to be a blend, the outcome to be a blend of both voices. But I think just going chapter to chapter, even though we both knew what stories we were talking about, would have been too fragmented.
That's like one of those chain novels. No, but basically you do a draft and then you mail it, and we just kept sending it back and forth until we were happy. I don't remember how many pass-throughs we had. We just kept doing it until we were ready.
Six, seven
passes, basically.
How do you know when you're ready, then?
I don't know. You know, but you don't. I mean, I think if I went back and looked at some of my older novels, there's things I do differently. You just have to kind of have a sense of comfort, like it's time to quit.
Jonathan and Faye Kellerman, now that you've worked on these, you've talked about these other books, are there any really, really unusual projects either are you working on now?
I would like to do a book about my guitar collection. I am a serious guitarist, been playing my whole life, and I have a pretty large collection of vintage instruments, and I want to do an art book on the guitar in America and what it's meant to me. I have an okay from publisher, but I just have to finish a couple of novels first, basically.
I'm working on just my novels and just this, and that's plenty for the time being.
Well, given that right now you're working on a specific theme novel set in another time, that's kind of it.
It's been very time-consuming, fun and time-consuming.
You've been listening to an interview with Faye Kellerman and Jonathan Kellerman, whose book is Double Homicide, Boston and Santa Fe. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.